From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Michael Martinez, sitting in today for Kodjo Namdi. You can watch live streaming video of this broadcast and the legendary Tom Sherwood at kojoshow.org. He's our resident analyst, a reporter for NBC4 and the current newspapers. How is it going, Tom?
Well, it's Friday, so it's always looking up, and the weather's going to be good this weekend, and maybe people can relax after a pretty tough week.
Yeah, Father's Day this weekend as well, and we do have a lot of ground to cover today because so much has happened this week. Later in the show, I'll be talking to Maryland State Senator Richard Mantovano about local reactions to last weekend's shootings in Orlando, Florida. And before we get into our first segment here about the results of this week's local election in the district, I do want to ask you about what you saw in our region's response over the past week. The news broke out about the shootings at Pulse, a gay nightclub in Orlando, right in the middle of the Pride festivities taking place here in D.C.
Well, I want to be respectful to it because there was a great deal of emotional response from all sorts of people. There are many people are want to move from shock and sadness to anger over what happened. You know, thoughts and prayers only go so far in terms of an event like this, the worst mass murder shooting in our country's history. You know, Larry Hogan, the governor of Maryland, put out a statement that he and his wife were shocked and offered assistance to the governor of Florida. But the question is, how do you stop these types of things? It's very difficult. You listen to the FBI about the lone wolf, the one person out of thousands, tens of thousands of people who might go off and do something like this. So as much as the sadness is from the shooting, it's the kind of helplessness that some people feel about what can we do. I mean, I thought after Sandy Hook, when 20 young children just barely get starting their lives were mowed down with guns, that something more would be done. And now that we've had 49 people killed in a club in Orlando, even as some senators were saying on the floor in the filibuster this week, what will we do besides say that we're sorry? And I don't know the answer to that.
And we'll talk more about that with Rich Mantovano later in the show. First, we've got our first order of business is to talk about the local elections here in the district.
Nothing happened.
If you've got questions or comments for two of the winners of those races, you can call now at 800-433-8850. You can tweet us at Kodjo Show. Email us at kodjo@wamu.org. Go to kodjoshow.org as well. Watch the live video stream. We're joined in the studio by two men who are now the Democratic nominees for the D.C. Council. Robert White is a Democratic candidate for an at-large seat on the D.C. Council. Welcome to you. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me back.
And Trayon White is the Democratic nominee for the Ward 8 seat on the D.C. Council. Trayon White, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And we're not going to get that confused at all with having two Mr. Whites in the studio. Certainly, the biggest surprise in this primary was that three incumbents lost, three incumbents who were backed by the mayor. What did you take out of the results, both in your own races but across the city?
Well, I think each race,
and this is Robert White.
This is Robert White. I think each race was different, and we have to be careful not to too easily couch them into a singular race. But you know, people around the city, I think, are seeing issues with a city that is really prospering, but so many people not being able to participate. And what they were saying was, we want more participation in shared prosperity in the future of our city. And I think that we have to be smart enough to listen. And I think people also want to see a new and different style of politics here in the city. And the people.
What does that mean, new and different style of politics?
Well, it means that we ran a race that was very much about building bridges and working together to ensure that our entire city is prospering. And I think that they elected people that they felt confident would do that.
Trayon White, are you going to be building some bridges?
Absolutely. I think in my race, it was very powerful what happened. I think people from all walks of life came together to get behind me. It was a community effort. Even a lot of the candidates in the last election got behind me and supported me, who traditionally wasn't a Trayon White supporter. This is not my first race. This is my fourth race. And people, a lot
of talking about the school board races.
Absolutely. Yeah. Then a lot of young people, this is their first time voting or never engaged in politics, didn't care about politics, got on board because they felt like in the last race, Trayvon White was cheated. So they said, we have to do something. So we named our campaign slogan, Don't Just Stand There, Do Something 2016. So it motivated a lot of people to get involved.
And you ran in the special election a year ago to fill the seat that was vacated by Marion Barry. You lost by just a handful of votes to LaRubie May. What was the difference this time?
The difference was people got involved. We changed our strategy a little bit. We had a fundraising chair this time, Kim Dickens. We leveraged power with other people we knew that was going to get in the race and asked them not to get in the race to get behind us. And we went back to our ground game through Manpower DC. We got them involved and got the guys together and the ladies together, and we went to work. You know,
I remember on the election night a year ago, whenever that election was, at April 1st of 2015, whatever it was. I can't even remember what that election was. And so we have too many elections in the city. I stood there, and you said the same night that you lost, barely lost, something about 78 votes or something, that your next campaign started that moment, that you were not taking any time off, you were going to run again. There's a lot of high expectation for you.
Yep.
You have the mayor, even today, Mayor Bowser was touting the unemployment rate has dropped something like almost 4%, which is a lot. But there's a lot of need in Ward 8. Expectations are you're going to do something. Can you give us a sense of how you're going to go out running? I don't think you have any real opposition in November, do you?
Not that I know of, but if they show their head, we're going to squash them as well.
Squash them.
No, squash them. There we go. All right. So high expectations. What can you do as a council member, a ward council member, different from what LaRubie May did or even what Marion Barry did before you?
So I think that we're in a unique time where we're going to experience a lot of economic development in the ward. And we want to leverage that to make sure people are able to develop at the same time. So as buildings go up, we want to make sure small businesses are getting a piece of the pie in the project, make sure they're able to hire from the community. Because you're not a friend of the community, you're not a friend of Ward 8. And so we want to, I did a little bit of that while on the school board. Like I've courted Microsoft, and we got Microsoft inside of Ballou Anacostia High School. It's about building relationships. I'm a business major by trade. And so I like to leverage a lot of those relationships in the business community with, you know, the Marriott was a good partner of ours, and make sure we're able to get people to work and create training programs to have something at the end of it.
Let me, Michael, if you'll let me stay on Ward 8 for just a moment if we get to that large race. On this show a couple of weeks ago, Andy Shalal, who is the leader of the Bus Boys and Poets business, opening the place on Martin Luther King right just north of Good Hope Road, right over the 11th Street Bridge. He's been known to hire people, entry-level jobs, train them. He says some of his top officials in his government, his corporation now, are people who started at the bottom. Mm-hmm. And he's planning to train people in Ward 8. He's planning to hire them and be part of the community. But he's been heavily criticized for being part of the gentrification of Ward 8. I can't remember
her
name.
He was on the show with Skyla Pondexter Moore, one of the correspondents for our Anacostia Unmapped project.
And she said that the people who live in Ward 8 don't have any equity. They're not brought in on the equity level, and they are just consumers and maybe employees, but they're not in the equity business. Do you see that also as a real problem? Andy Shalal is one of the most progressive politicians in town.
Well, we like what Andy is proposing in the ward. They're working in close partnership with the Far Southeast Family Strength and Collaborative. Mm-hmm. So we're going to make sure we got a strong community partnership with it as well. But also, I think we got to be a little more innovative and get money to small businesses across the ward, because a lot of people that own businesses in our community don't look like us. So we want to use the government resources to incentivize business to come to Ward 8 and start new and make sure we get a hand of the projects in Ward 8.
Well, and I think Skyla's point when she was talking specifically about Andy's businesses, the Bus Boys and Poets restaurants, is she said, look at what's happened in the neighborhoods where he's gone to. And we can debate whether or not this is a cause and effect thing. But she said, look at what happened at the 14th and V location. Look at where things have happened around in Ward 5 where he is in
Catholic University.
So when you look at those parts of the city where things have changed so much, what do you see as what you want to happen in your part of the city in Ward 8? Do you worry about that happening?
Absolutely. That's one of the reasons why people elected me over my opponent, because they felt like they wanted somebody who knew what was going on in the community and cared about the issues that they faced that's from the community. And I think I bring that to the table. And so part of what we want to do legislatively is create displacement-free zones to ensure that we're able to live there as the tax property, as the value of the property goes up, we freeze the taxes on those areas most affected by by development. And I think that's a way we use our legislative voice to ensure people are able to stay and grow in our own community.
Robert, gentrification is what we're talking about, to use the word. The good news, economic, even Tony Williams said it in a recent discussion with the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute, the increase in business brings the money that allows the government to help the people in the lower end hand up. Where do you see this rolling? The city is rapidly changing. People feel like they're being pushed out, not physically being pushed out, but, you know, the economic pressures and the rising taxes hurt small businesses. Where do you fit in from a citywide perspective? Because it's gentrification is happening in virtually every part of the city.
That's right. And my family has been victim of this gentrification.
So your father moved in, right?
My father, my brother, most of my family, actually. I'm a fifth-generation Washingtonian. Most of my family now lives in Maryland for solely financial reasons. And we've seen this. Our family house on 15th and Allison, my grandfather bought in 1963 for $14,000. Those houses are probably worth $900,000, $1 million now. And so we want the city to grow. We are always looking for ways to increase our tax base, but the question that we have to ask ourselves is, what are we using these tax dollars for? Are we using them to protect the people that are being left out and pushed out? And we have to make sure that we answer that affirmatively.
The city has a law in the books, which, it's, to my knowledge, has never been used, which would allow if there's an apartment building, for example, in a gentrifying neighborhood where the owner wants to get rid of Section 8 housing or just simply wants to redo it and charge higher rents or turn it into condos, the city has a program I don't believe ever used where the city itself can buy the building and then work out some ownership agreement with the tenants. It's never been used. And Anita Bonds has looked at this and said, you know, a lot of people in town who have Section 8 housing, which is a subsidized lower income housing program, they're bailing out. They're giving notice to the federal government. They're no longer going to be part of it because they can make their buildings much more valuable to them by turning them to the private sector.
That's right. That's the District Opportunity to Purchase Act. Many of us for
DOPA,
years.
DOPA. What a horrible name.
have asked
there's
why.
A TOPA, too.
There's a TOPA and a DOPA, and it's not working.
Right. And we have a number of very good laws in the books that are not being implemented or not being enforced, and that's why one of the things I've been talking a lot about in my campaign is not new legislation, but enforcement of legislation that we have now. We have an epidemic with people, low-income people, being priced out of this city, and we simply are not doing enough about it.
Well, let's ask then, was this election, even though the races were three different races, was this a referendum? A lot of people think it was a referendum, Mayor Muriel
Well,
Bowser.
Actually, let me take a call from somebody who I think is about to ask you all just that, and I want to follow it up with a tweet as well. We're going to go down to Katie in Washington, D.C. Katie, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi there. How are you doing today?
Doing well.
Excellent. Yeah, so I've seen a lot of information in the press about the green team, and I think they're now calling it Racine or the paint team or something like that, and whether people are opposed to Mayor Bowser. And I guess this question can go to both of you, but I'm really interested in hearing what Robert has to say. Are you against the mayor? Are you part of one of those teams? And how will that affect your future council role?
Okay, Katie, thanks so much for your call. And I want to follow this up with a tweet that I got last night from Karen Travers. She's actually a reporter at ABC who lives in Ward 4, so she's now one of your constituents. And she tweeted, "Their elections are portrayed as a rejection of Bowser and her policies. Do your voters want you to work with her?"
I think this city needs us to work with her. None of us benefit if the council and the mayor are not working together for the good of this city. And I've been clear from the first day of my campaign that I was not running in opposition to the mayor.
But she came by your election.
She
you
did.
Have
she
a,
was
you
very
put out
kind.
A picture of
she,
you and her.
Yeah,
I don't think she came by triumph. Did she?
No.
Well, she came by and I actually called her the next day and she answered just to reconfirm with her that that my hand is extended and that I want to work with her. None of us benefit from our mayor failing, and people don't want to see this type of opposition. They want to see progress, not political games. They want to see progress.
What about Katie's suggestion about there being a Racine team on the council? I saw you shaking your head about that for a second.
Yeah.
Trayon, what do you
think? Should we explain what that is?
Yeah, Carl Racine, the the city's first elected attorney general.
He's hired both of these guys.
He's hired both of them, and a lot of people expect that Carl Racine will be one of those people who will challenge the mayor and when she's up for re-election.
I think this is a spin that the media uses to kind of get a lot of attention. I was running for office way before I even met or heard of Carl Racine. And I think that after the race, Carl Racine did a wise thing to hire us in his office to connect with the community. We did a lot of community outreach. I'm very connected in Ward 8. So I think it was a smart move. But there is no coalition that Carl Racine has to have Robin and I running. I think that we are, great men in the community that people love and care about, and is going to do a great job leading. But there's no coalition that Carl Racine
has. So where are you with Mayor Bowser? She told me on Wednesday that she had reached out to all the candidates but had not reached them all. So maybe she's tried to reach you.
So I did get a chance to speak with the mayor. My phone died that night, so she did call me and leave me a message, and I did return a phone call.
What did you guys say?
She congratulated me on my win and told me she looked forward to working with me. Also, other council members came, like Mendelson, McDuffie, Silverman came to our came that night, and so we look forward to working with the mayor and other council members.
Speaking of phone calls, you can join our conversation by calling 800-433-8850. You can tweet us at Kodjo Show, or you can email us at kodjo@wamu.org. You can go to kodjoshow.org, watch the live video stream, or leave a question or a comment there. I'm Michael Martinez, sitting in today for Kodjo Namdi, joined as always by Tom Sherwood, our resident analyst, and we're talking with Robert White, the Democratic nominee for the at-large seat on the D.C. Council, and with Trayon White, no relation, the Democratic nominee for the Ward 8 seat on the D.C. Council. And we actually did just get a call from Peter in Washington, D.C., who wants, I believe, to ask a question to Trayon. Peter, you're on the air. What's your question?
Hi. I understand, the situation with school modernization in Ward 8 has been very poor, that the 21st Century School Fund has just gotten finished doing this big database looking at sort of equity issues involved in school modernization in D.C., and Ward 8, unfortunately, is a poster child for this inequality. And if you look at Stanton Elementary School and Garfield Elementary School, well, Stanton Elementary School's gotten a modernization, but doesn't have any kind of a library. They haven't done anything for the playground. And Garfield probably isn't going to see anything for 7 or 8 years. And this is a school that's 105 years old, the building. Or the main building, and it seems to me that the mayor didn't do your opponent any favors by not soldiering those buildings further along, bringing them up in the queue.
Okay,
and
Peter.
What you plan on doing about soldiering it forward? Thanks.
Okay, Peter. Let's let Trayon White answer. Thanks so much for your call.
So we just feel like a lot of our schools has been on the back burner for modernization for the last couple of years. Even with Baloo being online, we had to go down and take the whole Baloo band down to City Hall, and Mayor for Life Marion Berry had to advocate for that. So we are going to organize people to make sure we get back to the front of the line, even all elementary school. I served on the State Board of Education during those times. And so we got a heavy lifting Ward 8, and we're committed to working every day to make sure we are promoting that we're just not getting equality, but equity and moving the needle fast.
Yeah, a lot of work has been done on schools, but still some significant work to be done. We have not talked about the Democratic elephant in the room, and that's the return of Vincent Gray in Ward 7, beating Nevette Alexander, who had replaced him 9 years ago. Talking about the politics of working with the mayor, obviously you're both serious citizens of the city, so you're going to work with the mayor where you can. You'll disagree with her where you don't agree, and then it won't be personal, apparently. But some people are fearful that Mayor Gray, even though he says he won't throw rocks at the mayor, he didn't get elected to throw rocks at the mayor, will be a significant stumbling block for Mayor Bowser as she tries to work with this newly constituted council. Where do you think the Vince Gray election fits into this, the political politics of the city?
Well, I've listened to Mayor Gray very closely since his election, and I've heard him say that he's willing to work with the mayor and that he wouldn't throw rocks. And I've had the opportunity to work with him both as chair and as mayor when I was in Congresswoman Norton's office. So I'm confident that he understands I'm confident he understands what the city needs, and he's here to work for the good of the city.
Trayon, he says he will not. If there's an organized opposition against the mayor on the council, he will not be leading it.
I don't know what he's going to do. I can't speak for that man, but I know we want to work together as a council and with the mayor to ensure that our city is moving forward. And so I'm committed to doing just that, and I hope he is as well.
Question for you, Trayon, about one of the mayor's plans, and you can answer it as well since you're representing the entire city. Ward 8's changing rapidly, not always in ways that longtime residents feel that will benefit them. What's your position on the mayor's plans for this sports complex?
Well, I was not in favor of giving a billionaire $50 million of tax dollars with no written return on our investment, you know, and I think that we need to go back and look at that. And even bigger than that, it's a bit more to multi-billion dollar project happening on St. Elizabeth East Campus that the mayor held up from Red Brick. And so we want to make sure that we are a part of the conversation and things are not just shoved down our throat. And so we're going to work with the mayor and other council members to ensure we get a fair shake of how things go forward from now on the council.
A different piece of this question for you, Robert White. I also was tweeted this question from Andrew Huff, who works at American University, used to work for Jack Evans. At Huffy Tweets, wanted to know your thoughts on stadium developments, also at RFK, what future you would like to see for the RFK campus there. He also wanted to know your thoughts about some WWE wrestling event that's taking place this weekend. He's he and Brian Weaver are the two biggest local DC pro wrestling fans I know. But RFK, what in your heart of hearts should be the vision for that?
In my heart of hearts, I sit on have an unpaid board position on an organization called Winners Lacrosse, and we bring this program into DC public schools for free to provide an opportunity that's not generally provided to these schools. And so I know that we have a shortage of playing fields in this city, and I think that we have an opportunity, given the federal restrictions on this land, to add some fields that will add some play space. It's also good for the environment because it can capture the rainwater that's not happening now, and it would also, I think, go to address the concerns, the traffic concerns from the neighborhood who have put up significant opposition.
So is that in addition to an environmentally owner-paid-for football stadium? Or instead of?
I think it's instead of. I don't see how a modern stadium could go onto that footprint. I'm a huge football fan and a huge fan of our local team, but I don't see how a stadium would fit there. And I also do understand that the residents who live there feel very uncomfortable about that prospect. I think that there are better uses for the limited land that we have.
If the people who live up there are afraid of traffic horrors and not enough amenities for the people who live there, the advocates for the stadium say that there's almost 200 acres of land up there and that all the needs of the neighborhood can be met, all including those fields you just mentioned. And the stadium could be built on essentially the footprint of the old RFK. It wouldn't look like that hideous thing that they released a couple of weeks ago. It looked like a plastic bag in the Anacostia River. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but what about you, Trayon? I don't know if even you're a sports fan or not, but you know, football is a big business. It could bring jobs to the city. What do you think about it?
I don't live in that ward, but I think we should use that property for the best use of the community. I think a stadium is good, but I think we need to build around the stadium, more so retail space.
It has to be everything. It can't just be a stadium. Yeah, exactly. The mayor herself says there won't be 10,000 parking spaces.
A stadium alone is not good for the whole community, you know, because it's not open that often. It just sits there when it's vacant. So we need to build around the housing as well. We have a huge housing crisis here in D.C. that needs to be addressed as well. And that's a lot of land in D.C.
Tom, before we take another call, I do want to have you answer a tweet to help put this conversation in the right context. Adam Godet, I hope I said his name right, asked if someone can please explain the anti-Bowser camp's position / complaints about this.
What's wrong with Bowser?
Yeah.
Well, she's seen as not reaching out. I talked to one of her close people last night at I won't say where it was, but and it's that as much as she has tried in some cases, her administration has not reached out to the council members. You can hear this from Mary Che in Ward 3 talking about the homeless shelter programs, or David Grosso about other matters, is that the mayor has been aggressive on a lot of things, but not cooperative or not collegial. There's some tension between her and the council chairman about exactly who's on what page. You know, we had that incident a couple of weeks ago when the mayor in a public hallway cursed
it. Yeah, we got an F-bomb.
We got an F-bomb at Phil Mendelson over his rewriting of her homeless shelter plan. I think there's a sense, and I know the mayor's worked on this, but I got to say it, there's a sense that there's this almost elitist, detached image of her administration when it comes to dealing with the council. And she was on the council. She understands this. And I think she's going to try to work on it, certainly with the new members, and even with Mayor Gray. But that's the problem, is that her administration is a little too dismissive of the legislative branch.
Adam,
whether it's true or not, that's the feeling.
Adam, I hope that answered your question. Let's go back to the phones here to Alex in Washington, D.C. Alex, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, everybody. I was in Vietnam in 1968 when the riots were happening here in the district. And when I got back, my parents told me about what was going on, something called white flight, and everybody was really complaining about that, how terrible it was. And then over the years, now that so many have gone out there and realized that driving 2 hours each way is not doable anymore, they're coming back into the district, and now we're bemoaning the fact that we got gentrification. But I got to tell you, there's another side to the gentrification issue, because I have friends. One friend who lives on 11th and N Northwest, he got offered $1 million for his house. He's not complaining. And he's a black guy, and a black friend of mine whose aunt had a house there at 14th Street and W, she got a lot of money for her house. She's down in North Carolina, happy as a lark. So there's two sides to this, and I don't think you guys are paying attention to that.
Okay, Alex, thanks for your call. Robert White.
I definitely think I'm paying attention to it. Actually, I'd encourage you to read an interview I did on Petworth News about gentrification, where I, you know, was very clear that it's not as simple as most people think that it is. But the thing to remember is that for every person who's offered $1 million for their house is somebody else who wants to stay in their home, and those taxes are more than they can bear. And so there are not just two sides to this. There are many sides to this, and we would be well to not oversimplify it. And I got to tell you, it's one of the things I'm excited about taking on the council, because I come from a low-income African-American family here in D.C., but I am now an attorney. My wife is an attorney. We own a house. We are probably technically gentrifiers, even though I live next to the neighborhood I grew up in. But there's a way to use the increased resources and population in D.C. to benefit the many, and that's what we have to be focused on.
Well, we had a caller who just dropped, and I think she wanted to ask both of you about specific things that the council can do on affordable housing.
So I want to go back to the last question real quick, because part of what I hear, and this is Trayon speaking, is a lot of seniors are worried that they'll be pushed out, because most of them are getting Social Security checks or disability, and they're on fixed income. Mm-hmm. And they're worried that as the price of living goes up, they can potentially become the next homeless population.
Yeah, we have tax abatement programs for homeowners and senior citizens. But
the price of living still goes up for their medicine, yeah, and their
right,
food,
everything.
Everything. So.
And the caller talked about people bemoaning gentrification. I think what we're hearing is not that we don't want people of income and not dependent on the city services to come in the city. I think people do want the getting the city richer is good, because the question is, what do you do with the money the city has to make sure that everyone is included? I think that's the argument, not bemoaning the fact that people can sell a house for $1 million. Is that right, Trey?
That sounds about right.
There you go. I like those answers. Yes, I agree with you.
All right. We've got another call here for Trayon White from a Sue in McLean, Virginia. Sue, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to say that I commend to Anacostia, and I'm concerned about the blighted look that exists there. When you come over the bridge, there's a beautiful spot that where flowers were planted, and the weeds are so high, and there's a young woman standing there with her child waiting for the bus. And the trash that's up and down Martin Luther King Avenue and Good Hope Road, I don't see any excuse for that and why people should live in that condition when it's an easy fix. We're not talking a big issue here. It's an easy fix. Pick up the trash, weed the gardens, and make Anacostia more appealing as you come over that bridge.
Okay, Sue, thanks for your call.
So we know that there's a direct correlation between pollution and crime. And what the, one of the things we don't see in Ward 8 that we're going to see in Ward 8 is a schedule to clean the streets. You know, I go throughout the city and I see Wednesdays, this is the street cleaning day, or Thursdays. We don't have that in Ward 8. So my job as a council member is to use the government resource to ensure that at least we have clean streets. We do have a new team that cleans the business districts of Ward 8, led by Charlie Whitaker, which is excellent. And so we are moving in the right direction, but people have to start taking ownership of their own communities and cleaning up. And so my job is to be the leader. You know, I think everything rises and falls on leadership.
Well, let's talk about crime for a second, because when Vincent Gray was here on Wednesday, one of the things he talked to Tom and me about was the spike in violent crime in Ward 7, where there's been more than 24 homicides in 2016 so far, some of them in broad daylight. When you look at this issue from Ward 8 or throughout the entire city, what are specific things that you think the council could do, or what do you think are specific things that Kathy Lanier could do that would reduce violent crime?
So in my years, I've grown up in Ward 8. I've seen a divestment in youth services. A lot of the crimes I committed, young people between the age of 18 and 25. And what we've seen along the way is a lot of the resources for teenagers and young adults have been cut out. Boys and Girls Club has been closed. Blue Rec closed. Oral Rec closed. Hot Rec closed. You can go down the list of services that has been closed. And so we have to give them, the young people, something constructive to do, because if we don't, then they may do things that are destructive. So as a councilman, we want to get investment back into after-school programs, mentoring programs, through our Safeway Home Act that we created within our campaign. And so we want to make sure we create wraparound services with the collaboratives in the community and the organizations to make sure we redirect and give a stronger vision to education, you know, and careers in our community, because we can even close down schools in D.C., saying we're doing a consolidation. We have not seen a benefit yet from consolidating schools that we said we was going to see.
Robert White.
Yeah, and I'd like to add to that. This is a good opportunity to be vocal about something I'm passionate about, which is Kenya McDuffie's crime bill, which I think sought to take a proactive approach to crime in the long term, will really help our city by addressing the issues that lead into crime. And I think it's really important that we take another look at funding this piece of legislation.
And are we talking about the piece of legislation that would provide subsidies to resident citizens?
Right, but that's one small piece. That's kind of the
and
sexy
that's attracted
piece.
A lot of attention.
You're talking about when people misidentified his idea that we'll pay people not to commit crimes, when the idea was to go out and find people who might likely commit crimes and get them into program.
That's right.
Hugely different description.
Hugely.
But it came off as, let's pay people to stay home and not commit crimes, which was insulting, I think, to the people who live there.
I think that's right. It was much more sophisticated than it was portrayed, and I think that at least as a pilot program, collecting data and looking to see if it works, we have very little to lose and a lot to gain.
Let me add to that real quick, because what I noticed when that happened, we fought against the mayor's bill. I know a group of my constituents did, and we didn't get any funding for McDuffie's bill, which people were in favor of, if you look at the council hearing during that time. And so we have to start lobbying the mayor to put the resources where it's needed.
There's a lot to go on. This politics hour. You got to talk to – you have to do this after November the election, when you're actually the elected person to take office January 2nd. What committee do you want Chairman Phil Mendelson to put you on?
Oh, I want to be on the –
Trayon.
Okay. I want to be on the Judiciary Committee, Health and Human Services Committee, and Education Committee.
Education White. And Economic Development. And Mr. Chairman, you can let me chair a committee.
Well, we'll see about that.
All right, let's take another call here from Tony, who says he's calling from Logan Circle. Tony, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, everyone. Congratulations on your races. Tonight, there is the second day of the Constitutional Convention. 2 months ago, a draft constitution was released for statehood. You know, we have more people than Wyoming and Vermont. We want to be a state like them. I assume you've read the draft constitution, so I want to know, what do you think about its proposal for structuring the council and the ANCs? Do you support it, or do you agree with many who think that our legislature should be different, have more members, have two houses like Wyoming and Vermont?
Robert White, go ahead.
I
assume you couldn't go to the one on Monday night. That was the day before your election.
Right, there's one tonight and there's one Saturday. And then they'll get this Constitution put together. They'll submit it to the mayor and the people will submit it to the Board of Elections in July. They hope it'll be on the ballot in November. They hope it'll pass. It probably would, whatever it says. And then they're going to send it to Congress and try to get statehood if the Democrats win the Senate and the Democrats win the White House.
That's right. The caller made a very important point. Vermont, the state, has less people in it than D.C., but their state legislature, which is, you know, our council is the equivalent of our state legislature, is 180 people, a bicameral body. Wyoming is 90. We have 13 people representing the interests of almost 800,000 people. I think that we absolutely have to take a look at the structure of
We would do. So you sound like you'd want more. You want how many people should be a legislature? You don't want 180 legislature.
No,
do
I don't.
Trayon, what about you?
I think we do have to look at it because D.C. is so young in government. We have to find a way to grow our government to make sure we fit the needs of the entire D.C. I'm going to the one on Saturday. I haven't been really focused on it because I've been focused on winning this election. But I actually went to jail for statehood at the White House a few years back, so I feel very strongly about statehood for D.C.
Are you going to attend either tonight or tomorrow?
I have to ask my wife permission for everything at this point. We have 3 weeks until we have a baby, and she's been completely occupied with the campaign. But I do plan to be there tomorrow.
Good to know.
Well, that will do it for Robert White and for Trayon White, two of the Democratic nominees who won primaries on Tuesday for the D.C. Council. Congratulations to both of you. I'm not sure whether to say congratulations or sorry now that it's in the cards that you're going to be seeing a lot more of Tom Sherwood in the future. You can decide whether or not that's a good thing or a bad thing. But we look forward to having you back on the show. So thanks so much for making time for us today.
Thank you.
It's a unity breakfast in Ward 8 tomorrow, Saturday. Or lunch Saturday. You're going to drop by that maybe.
Absolutely.
All right. So is LaRubie May, I'm told. So that's a good thing.
Yep.
Tom Sherwood, we're going to talk on the phone with Richard Mantlano, state senator from Maryland, in just a minute. But another big piece of news in Maryland that came out this week was that Larry Hogan, the state's governor, very popular governor right now, Republican in a very blue state, said publicly that he's not planning on supporting Donald Trump for president. What'd you make of that?
Well, he said, I don't plan to vote for him. And I think that's he's been consistent now for several months. He's been a fairly successful governor, a Republican governor, as you say, in a blue state. And I think that's important for him. He said he's not going to go to the convention in Cleveland. It's too bad I wanted to cover him there. There are many Republicans nationwide who are very dissatisfied with the Trump candidacy, and it's going to be played out more and more as we go forward. But Hogan is looking towards he's going to run for re-election in 2018. He doesn't want to have to be saddled with the idea that he threw in his support with Donald Trump. You know, he supported Chris Christie, and when Chris Christie got out,
Chris Christie was a big supporter of him.
You know, and vice versa. Well, yes, there's mutual admiration society. But when he got out, Hogan got out.
Let's see what our next guest has to say about that on the phone. We're joined now by Richard Mantlano. He is a member of the Maryland State Senate. He's a Democrat from Montgomery County. Rich Mantlano, thanks so much for making time for us today.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
What did you make of the governor saying that he did not plan on voting for Donald Trump?
Well, it was a fascinating maneuver. I mean, fortunately, the press corps stayed on top of him for several weeks saying, you know, where are you on this? And he finally, after dodging the question for a long time, took a position. So, I mean, I wish he would understand why the Democratic nominee is the superior choice and go along with her as opposed to just saying, you know, maybe he'll write in someone else. Who knows? He'll write in Tom Sherwood while he's in the...
Well, here's Tom Sherwood.
Well, that's funny, but, you know, that's not... You know, he's in a difficult... You know, I realize you're in different parties, and you guys will put somebody up to defeat him in a couple of years. But it seems to me he's trying to thread the needle on this. He's trying to say, look, I'm running the state of Maryland. I'm not into all the some of what people say were the craziness of the Donald Trump's positions or the extreme positions that some people do like. But it seems to me it's a smart political move on his part to focus on Maryland and let the national politics go where they may.
Well, it's interesting that you would say it's a smart political move because Donald Trump won the Maryland primary substantially by a significant margin. And I think, you know, that I don't know if he had locked in the nomination by the time he had the primary rolled around in Maryland on the Republican side. So, you know, it might be you think it's smart and trending for the general election in 2018, but you know, there are a lot of Republican voters who are central to his reelection who voted for Donald Trump.
Oh, you think he'd face a primary challenge because of his failure to go with the party?
I don't, in 2006, you know, there are a lot of Republicans who became disenchanted with Robert Ehrlich and weren't there to show up to vote. I mean, it could be very interesting that there could be a lack of excitement amongst the Republican base to show up to vote in places like Montgomery County, where, believe it or not, Donald Trump won rather significantly, that maybe people show up and or don't show up for Larry Hogan because they remember he wasn't there when their party needed – when their nominee needed him in 2016, why should they come out in 2018?
If you've got questions or comments for Maryland State Senator Richard Madaleno, you can give us a call at 800-433-8850. You can tweet us at Kojo Show, email us at kojo@wamu.org. You're listening to The Politics Hour. I'm Michael Martinez, sitting in today for Kojo Namdi. And we're joined, as always, by Tom Sherwood, our resident analyst reporter for NBC4, columnist with the current newspapers. You go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to do one more political thing before I want to get to the Orlando, horrific Orlando thing. But, you know, this Maryland, of course, is the blue state. Virginia is considered a battleground state, purple tilting maybe towards Democrats in the last elections. But, you know, in the Republican Party in Virginia is organizing, getting together. Jim Gilmore, the former governor, is the leader of his state Republican, I think it's the Virginia team or Team Virginia. And now this week, Corey Stewart, the Prince William County chairman, has joined in. He's the leader of the Trump forces. They seem to be in Virginia, at least the Republicans are organizing because they think they've got a really tough race. And the poll this week came out showing that Hillary Clinton is just barely ahead of Trump in for the November election because the Bernie Sanders people are not yet turning to her.
And I'll add that next week we'll be talking with Corey Stewart on this show.
Oh, good.
Rich Madaleno.
You want me to comment about Virginia?
Sure. I'm just saying.
Virginia will get in line by the end of the, if Donald Trump's campaign continues its wonderful march as we've seen over the last few weeks. And
are you donating to his campaign now? Because you like the way it's going?
I'm certainly not donating to his campaign, but I find myself fixated by his speeches because it's what's going to happen next. I mean, it is like watching a train wreck. So it's fascinating to watch and to see how many other people are going to be pulled down by this. You know, we have a Senate race in Maryland, a United States Senate race in Maryland, in November. And, you know, we're putting up a fantastic nominee in Representative Chris Van Hollen. The Republicans have a nominee who is supportive of Donald Trump. I don't know what's going to happen in their races and for the congressional seats in Maryland. If you have the governor avoiding the Republican nominee, the Senate nominee embracing the Republican nominee for president. I mean, they're running towards a mess that could have, again, impacts on Larry Hogan and the Republican Party moving forward.
Senator Madaleno, let's shift gears away from politics. We started the broadcast today by talking about the shootings in Orlando, Florida, which took place while Pride festivities were going on here in Washington, D.C. I know that this is a personal story to you. How did you react when you heard about what happened last weekend?
Well, Mike, you pointed out that it was a Pride festival. We, my husband and I and our kids marched with a group of other gay and lesbian-headed families, the Rainbow Families of Washington, D.C., with a human rights campaign on Saturday afternoon in the parade. And it was just remarkable, the outpouring of people, the length of the parade, all of the different officials that were there. I mean, as a longtime, long-suffering fan of the Washington Capitals, you had the all-star goalie as one of the leading the parade. I mean, it was amazing to see sort of this embrace. And there were several times my husband and I talked about, wow, can you think about how much this has changed from like 25 years ago when I first went to a pride parade, and then to wake up Sunday morning and seemingly have all of those good feelings come crashing down as, you know, the story just got worse as the day went on, the news, the fact that, you know, clearly gay people were targeted by the killer. So, I mean, it just, it reminded us of how much hate is still out there, how vulnerable our community remains, and that any minority group remains within a society. And, you know, it was from feeling of almost elation and victory to, oh my, I didn't, you know, a reminder of how far we still have to come.
Senator, I don't know if you heard me at the beginning of the program. You may have had something to do, but I did mention both the horrific nature of this shooting in Orlando, and I went back to the Sandy Hook kids, the 20 kids who were killed. And I said then that I thought that was going to be the cathartic moment where the country would address the issue of the easy availability of guns. Do you have any sense that we won't just repeat this pattern again, that everyone expressed their outrage over Orlando, and now a week will have gone by? I mean, it's just been a year ago that the shooting in Charleston, in the church. Do you see any movement where there might be some action, you know, for to do something? What it is, we can fight over politically, but it seems to me we always end up fighting and doing nothing about, I guess, guns or the terror threat that we all face.
There's a fascinating meme going on Facebook and Twitter right now, which is, you know, more or less however you want to describe it. And I was trying, as you were asking me the question, I was furiously trying to find it.
I've been reading your tweets,
but it was more or less aimed at, okay, you have gone after the wrong community. I mean, look at what the gay community has done over the last 20 years in various places around this country and in the nation, as far as advancing our rights and having, you know, fortunately, in many ways, victory after victory. Like you've woken the wrong giant when it comes to this issue. I noticed that the Human Rights Campaign, which is the largest LGBT advocacy group in the country, is now going to come out in favor of gun violence prevention measures. So, I mean, to me, I think we're going to be. On one side, I'm looking at it thinking, if you could kill a group of first graders, it's hard to get a more innocent group. If you could slaughter a large group of first graders and not have any legislative action, I don't know how this is going to change things this time, because if you think the LGBT community is influential, first grade parents, usually a very larger influential group in our country. But who knows? Now, maybe, sadly, so many different groups of people have been targeted that it just builds a coalition, that it's not just any one group, or that it just keeps building the coalition of something has to change.
Well, I have a question for you about where things stand right now in Maryland, and if you could clear this up for me, it would be great. It's my understanding that back in 2013, Maryland did ban semi-automatic high-capacity assault weapons after the Newtown massacre at Sandy Hook. It's my understanding that law is currently being challenged in court. Where does that stand right now?
So it is before the Fourth Circuit, the appellate court in Richmond, as far as the federal appeal circuit that we're part of. So we won at the trial court level. We lost at the initial appellate level, a 2-1 decision. We appealed it. You know, I think the right term is en banc, so that the whole appeals court will hear the case, and that's where we are right now. I mean, look, the NRA knew that they could have petitioned a referendum, the ban on assault weapons like the one that was used in Orlando that we passed in 2013, and they thought about doing a petition drive to try to get the the bill on referendum, like what happened with the marriage equality law, and try to overturn it with the voters, and they realized they didn't stand a chance because that was going to be – the polls showed the public wanted it, and it was going to be embraced. So they avoided the democratic process and have decided to go through the courts to overturn the measure. So we're trying to wait and see what happens with this next round of appeals. But you're right, the weapon that was used in Orlando, you could not buy that now in the state of Maryland. You can, as a Marylander, you can't go to a state where it is legal to buy it and buy it and bring it back. We put a limit on the number of rounds that you can buy in a clip. We've tried to take action to make sure that the type of weapon that was used is no longer available in the state of Maryland.
We've got time for one more question, and I'm going to let Tom Sherwood ask it.
I want to mention that Kathy Saliga, I think is how you say her name, the Republican candidate for Senate in Maryland, has in fact denounced Donald Trump's position of talking about the judge, saying it was racist for him to question the ethnic heritage of the judge. So she has spoken out and somewhat distanced herself from Trump in that campaign. The Virginia poll we mentioned earlier about that race there said that 88% of the voters support background checks on all gun purchases. 55% support banning assault weapons. Do you think this, again, back to my original question, do you think something can get done this time?
And answer that very briefly.
I hope so, but it needs to happen at the federal level. We can't just keep doing this on a state-by-state basis. It's only through concerted, broad federal action are we really going to make a difference in trying to rein in gun violence in our country.
Richard Maddalena, we're looking forward to continuing the conversation more with you about this and about Maryland politics later. In the meantime, have a great weekend. Have a happy Father's Day weekend, and thanks so much for making time for us today.
Thank you so much for having me on, and happy Father's Day to everyone, too.
That was Richard Maddalena. He is a member of the Maryland State Senate. He is a Democrat from Montgomery County. Tom Sherwood, that's going to do it for the show today.
Happy Father's Day to you, and you'll be with your dad, I think.
I will be with my dad.
And I'll be brunching with my son. It'll be great.
The Yankee fan.
Uh-oh.
That's it for the show today, but remember that we've got lots more for you online and in person. Tomorrow, Kojo Namdi Show producer Taylor Burney will be in conversation with bestselling author Emma Straub at Politics and Prose on Connecticut Avenue at 6 p.m. They'll discuss Straub's new novel, Modern Lovers. Details are available at WAMU.org/books. And the next phase of SafeTrack starts Monday, and local officials say it's going to be a doozy. Find out what you need to know before it hits by checking out the Metropocalypse podcast. Find it at WAMU.org/metro. Enjoy the lovely weekend weather, and be sure to meet us back here Monday at noon when we'll be talking about that next phase of Metro SafeTrack and what's at stake for local commuters. Plus, thanks to Obamacare, mental health coverage is now officially part of most healthcare plans, but a recent study finds DC psychiatrists can't keep up with demand. That's coming up Monday at noon. Until then, happy Father's Day to everyone, including my dad right here in DC. I love you, Pop. Thank you all for listening. I'm Michael Martinez, sitting in for Kojo Namdi.
Thanks for listening to the Kojo Namdi Show. And if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at WAMU.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.